I'm your chairman. Thank you. I'd like to welcome everyone to our 11th annual Heritage Day, and I'm glad that you're all here. We had an excellent turnout here today. I hope you all enjoy the lunch, and we have a we have another nice program waiting for you for the speaker and all that stuff. I'm just going to make a few announcements and introduce some of our officers and whatnot. What I would like to start out with is everyone to stand up, please. Okay, I'd like to take a few minutes to introduce some of the officers we have here. Let's see, I'll start with the State Assembly officers. Pat D, please. Where is Pat D? She's our chairman. Pat I, who is our secretary. Sylvia G, who is our chairman-elect, or the alternate chairman. Let's see who else we have. We have Dottie S for, Dottie R. She's our newsletter chairman. Tanya S. I'm sorry, I'm trying to get to my list. Tanya S. She's our forum coordinator. And Joe H., he's our finance and budget coordinator. And let's see, we also have a few coordinators here. Institution coordinator, Shirley J. from Idalia. And I'm your state CPC coordinator. Let's see, did I leave anyone from the state level, state assembly level? Okay, I'll introduce to you some of our AIS office officers. AIS office comprises of five districts, District 4, District 9, 13, 14, and 16. And I'm the chairman of the AIS office. And Joe H. is our chairman-elect. Our treasurer, N.F., she's in the back. And our Alateen coordinator, Susan L. Our Caterpillar coordinator, Patty B. That's it. And our meeting schedule coordinator, Carolyn D. And our telephone coordinator, Ruth H. And I'd like all the DR to stand up, please. District representatives. F. Flores, District 4. Tamron is District 13. Just introduce yourself, so.
17.
Go ahead, Abby.
District 14.
So we have quite a few people in the service work, and some of you who may be thinking about venturing out into service work, these are the people you can talk to and get some information to see, you know, what they do. And it is really a rewarding thing to do, to get involved with the service work, and they are, you know, the local level as well as the state assembly level. There are quite a few positions that they're very interesting and very rewarding. So keep in mind and try to get some service work done, and that's very rewarding. I'd like to make a few other announcements. There is a card. Another person that is not here with us, Ruby W., she's our delegate. She's on her way to New York to attend the WSO conference. And that's one person that very few people know, that they work so hard for the program and the fellowship, that it's really a tremendous amount of time that they commit to do the work all the time, plus attend this WSO seminars. And I have a card here somewhere if you all want to sign it. And if you haven't signed it, I think it's the front desk. And we will mail it out at the end of the day to her. So at least she will receive the card. At least she will feel that, you know, there are people out there thinking about her and really appreciate the kind of work she does for us. I see Terry is leaving early, so if you all want to buy the tape, put your name in ahead of the time so he can get the tape ready for you. The bingo cards, you all receive one card, but there are extra cards available. You can buy a dollar each or six for $5 that we will play bingo later on. So if you would like to buy extra cards, go ahead and get some from the front desk. Our AIS office is running low on our budget and finance, so we have been trying different ways to raise the money. And one of the things that Pebble is doing, that she's going to conduct the raffles and whatnot for different articles, and you see a little beautiful flower vase that is sitting up there that we are going to raffle out at the July AIS quarterly meeting. And I think there are, you can buy three chances for a dollar, so if you want to contribute for the local AIS office fund, please buy some of those tickets. And you can buy those tickets at the AIS office also. There is also a literature sale booth set up here, and that's something that I always forget. This lady, I'm sorry, I'd like to introduce to you Joyce G., who is our literature coordinator. She does such a wonderful job. I don't know why I forget her, but I always miss her. At least this time I remember. But she has been doing the literature work for so many years, and it's almost automatic, and you know, we don't realize how much work is involved, but she orders some like $12,000 worth of literature, and we sell that much literature through our AIS office. And that means ordering at least $1,000 worth of literature every month. And that takes a lot of coordination, a lot of inventory, and knowing, you know, what is low and what is required. But she does it such a natural to her that it's almost automatic, and we don't really appreciate how much good work she does. We also have the Al-Anon convention, I should say conference brochure, also those dark blue colors. So if you want to register, I think that is on in first weekend of June. I think it's June 4th or 5th, if I'm not mistaken. 4th, 5th, and 6th in Lafayette at Hilton Hotel. 2, 3, and 4. 2, 3, and 4, yeah. And we have quite a few good speakers and you know, fun things like dance in the evening. So it's a really fun thing to do. So if you don't want to turn in your reservations, all that stuff, so those are the forms you can use. That's about all I have. Okay. I'll get Dottie to come and read the opening to start the meeting, please.
Thank you, Jane. Hi, everybody. My name is Dottie, and I'm a very grateful Al-Anon. And I think, like a lot of us, I'm very grateful to be here today. Let's open this meeting with a moment of silence, followed by the Serenity Prayer. God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. The Al-Anon family groups are a fellowship of relatives and friends of alcoholics who share their experience, strength, and hope in order to solve their common problems. We believe alcoholism is a family illness and that changed attitudes can aid recovery. Al-Anon is not allied with any sect, denomination, political entity, organization, or institution, does not engage in any controversy, neither endorses nor opposes any cause. There are no dues for membership. Al-Anon is self-supporting through its own voluntary contributions. Al-Anon has but one purpose, to help families of alcoholics. We do this by practicing the 12 steps, by welcoming and giving comfort to families of alcoholics, and by giving understanding and encouragement to the alcoholic.
Hi, I'm Tanya. And I was invited to introduce Barbara as our speaker this morning, and I just want to say thank you for the opportunity. She shared with me that I wondered why we had been having all these out-of-state speakers and everything, and that this year we were having Barbara. And since she's my friend, we can laugh about that. But anyway, I thought maybe we were short on money. But Barbara says we are. But I think that when she started explaining things to me, I understood the impact of having one of our own people from this area be our speaker today. And that has to do with the fact that for those of you who sat down before they said 10 years, you're like me and you don't know why Heritage Day, maybe you do know, but I didn't know why Heritage Day was started. And it was because they had so many newcomers in the area that really didn't know about the beginnings of Al-Anon and how the struggles and the obstacles that the old-timers had gone through without literature and all that. So they began to look for a way through the AIS office to have a program once a year or whatever that would introduce those of us who are new. And I'll share with you that my first one to hear was Elsa from California, so you know that was a long time ago too. And she explained a lot of things about old-timers to me, and I've remembered those things, and it meant a lot. So for those of you who are new today or have not been to one of these before, Barbara is our speaker, and she's done a lot to help get this program started for us. And she was one of the ones that was at the AIS office when this brainstorm occurred. In addition to that, she served as a GR, a DR, a public information coordinator, and became chairman of the state assembly, area assembly, and then was a delegate. And so she has served in a lot of capacities. And just to show you how things work, today she's a temporary GR for her group again. So before I turn it over to her, I wanted to say that if I had to use one word to say how I feel about Barbara, I think it would probably be the word respect. And I think that that's an important word. And I heard a child on the TV this week to say the words that to me represented respect, and it says, knowing a person and accepting that they're different from you and liking them anyway and letting them be themselves. So with that, I say to you, welcome to Barbara, and help me enjoy it. Join me in welcoming her and being grateful that she's here for us.
I'm not supposed to cry now. I'm a member of the Worldwide Fellowship of Al-Anon Family Groups, and I'm very grateful for that. My name is Barbara Miller Yaffe Knickerbocker Miller. And I'm saying that for a reason, and you'll see as I get into my talk. Can everyone hear me? I don't want you to miss any of this. I want to thank Pebble and Sylvia that asked me to speak here, and I want to be honest with you and tell you that I'm feeling somewhat like a fraud because I've come to this to hear other people talk, not me. And Tanya's right. We really wanted to let people know that we're new in the program what Al-Anon came from and the struggles that they had to get where we are today. They didn't have 14 books and 95 pamphlets and 62 meetings a week and whatever it is in your area. They had no literature at the very beginning, and then they had like one pamphlet and then two. So we've come a long way, baby. And I think that those of us that are newer need to know this. And we also need to know that Al-Anon has survived for 44 years because we do one thing and we do it well. And it's all we do. We don't try to make everybody in the world well. Al-Anon is for people who want it, not just for people who need it. And I'm glad you're all here. I love to see everybody at Heritage Day in their spring colors. And, you know, I put on legs. You know, I've got a pantyhose on for the first time in months. I asked a friend of mine, I said, are you sure I can't wear pants? And she said, no, I think you really need to wear a dress. I grew up in Fort Smith, Arkansas, in the mountains, and it's beautiful. And I was back there last weekend, and it still is. I grew up the older daughter of a very loving family. Now, I say that because I knew they loved me. They never told me they did, but I knew they did. And I grew up very spoiled. I'm a Jap. I don't know if any of you know what that is, but I'll tell you, it's a Jewish American princess. And I was raised that way. I don't think my father was wealthy, but I never knew that. And I went along the assumption that he was. And anything that I needed, I got. So I was okay in assuming that, I guess. I control teachers. My mother had a horror of me after I threw a tantrum in the shoe store because she wouldn't let me have the shoes I wanted, and I was 5 years old. So she never went shopping with me again. And I was Daddy's little girl, and I controlled him, and I controlled a lot of people in my life. I grew up, Fort Smith is a small town. It's getting bigger. I was surprised, but it is getting bigger. And when I grew up, there was one high school and one junior high and a lot of little elementary schools, and everyone you knew went to the one high school. And when I got a car early on, of course, I had a lot of friends because everyone wanted to go because they had, you know, I had a car. And I could make people go where I wanted them to go. If I didn't want to go to that place, we wouldn't, because I had the wheels. I never made a mistake. I was 35 years old before I ever made a mistake. Because I could twist my mind to think that that was okay, that was the way I really wanted it. If it wasn't, I couldn't admit that I was wrong. I could not admit that I had made a mistake, that I had done something wrong, that I had just not been perfect. And I don't know where this came from. I don't come from an alcoholic home. I have a lot of the behaviors that people growing up in alcoholic homes have, but my mother was physically ill. She had diabetes and heart trouble and all kinds of things. So I think that's probably where it came from. I know today that my parents were both addicted to prescription medicine. But I didn't know that at the time, and it never really affected me. We never had the things that I have come to connect with alcoholism and drug addiction in my home. They just didn't sleep at night, so they took sleeping pills, is what it amounted to. And I can remember sitting at the breakfast table, and Daddy had come in, and Mother would say, "How'd you sleep?" And he'd say, "I didn't sleep at all. I had to take a sleeping pill." And he'd ask her, and she'd say the same thing. So it was they were sleeping pills. I got married right out of high school. I was registered at the University of Oklahoma, and I had a roommate, and I had my tuition paid and everything, and I was going to meet a nice Jewish boy to marry. And I met him before I went, so I didn't go. I met him in my senior year of high school, and he had just moved back to Fort Smith and was in business. And he was a man of the world, and I was a senior in high school. And I skipped school for the only time I ever skipped school in that spring of my senior year, and I got caught, which is what usually happens to me when I do something I shouldn't. And he was getting a big kick out of it because his fiancée was having to stay after school. I went from Daddy's house with him telling me what to do and being in control of my life to Richard's house with him telling me what to do and being in control of my life. And I was married to him for 17 and a half years. And he's a good husband. He was a good man. But see, I have this illness. And it's very difficult for me to get bored. I mean, it's real hard when I do because I get in trouble. I got involved. He didn't want me to work, so I didn't work. I did good deeds, and I was on this board and that board, and I was chairman of this committee and that committee, and I had been in the paper, and I had been on TV supporting all these causes. And we had one show that I really liked. It was a benefit variety show for a school for retarded children. And we had given them a lot of money and given them like enough money to have a van and to build a building. And one year I was chairman of it, and I was high on life. I hadn't had a drink. Hadn't started really drinking yet, okay? This is not an drunkalogue, but I don't know why it isn't. But we were going to someone's house because the cast party was less than wonderful, and a couple of friends of mine that ended up in AA invited us to come to their house, and we were going, and he didn't want to go. And I was driving, and I said, I want to go, and I don't want to go home. And he said, I don't want to go. And I said, I'm going. And he said, just let me out. So I did. I left him on the street and drove to the party. I could have cared less. I wanted what I wanted when I wanted it. And when I got there, Brad asked me, he said, where's Richard? And I said, I let him out on Rogers Avenue. And he says, my God, why? And I said, because he didn't want to come. And he went and got him, and I think he took him home. That was the way I had grown up. I did what I did because I wanted it. It's what I wanted. I always got my way. I have two children. Saw my son last weekend and his wife and my grandson and his wife and my granddogs. And I now have a great-granddog, 4 months old, black lab. So my kids were normal, healthy. There was nothing wrong with them. They were growing up independent the way I wanted them to. Glenn could feed himself. She could wash, you know, clothes. They didn't have many responsibilities, but they were being taught a few things that I felt they would need to know along the line. And I got bored. My life had settled down. I didn't work. I had a maid. The kids were in school. I ran carpool. I went to committee meetings. I did lunch. I played golf, and I shopped. And I got bored. Every now and then when the kids were small, I would say, maybe I ought to get a job. And Richard would say, why, you can't do anything. Now, I had grown up somehow with the idea that, and it was the age, too, you know, that women didn't plan to have careers in those days. You went to school, found a husband, and got married and had children. And that was the way I was raised. That's what I thought I was supposed to do. But I got bored, and I would suggest it, and he'd say that, and then I'd say, well, never mind, and try to be okay with where I was. But I got bored, and my daughter wanted a horse. All her life, she'd always wanted a horse. And when she was 12, I told my husband that we were going to get her one, that we had a place to keep it, that we could board it, and we would go out, and I would take her out and feed it every day. So he relented. And a friend of mine, there were three couples that played golf together, and Ann had started riding horses, and so she helped us find a horse, and then she helped us find a better horse. She used to be my golf buddy, and when I realized that she wasn't around much to play golf anymore, I wondered why. And she was always off riding this damn horse. When Benet decided she wanted a better horse, Ann said, well, we can go to South Arkansas or Middle Arkansas and we can find one. I bet I've got some contacts down there. Well, on the way, she told me that she was married now and she had 4 kids, and she said, but I have a friend. And I was horrified. I couldn't believe that people did those things. And it wasn't too long before I was doing them too. It was exciting, and it was fun, and I liked the danger, and I felt desired and wanted and needed. Because you see, my husband was a workaholic, and he didn't need me. And my kids were growing up the way I raised them, and they didn't need me. And I got what I was missing from other people, other men. And I did that for 2 or 3 years. We would get the kids off school in the morning, drive like a bat out of hell to Russellville or Little Rock, spend the day with whoever, and be home in time to get the kids after school. And it's not a pretty time in my life, and it's not something I'm proud of, but it's the first time I've ever told it from the podium. I usually have said, my first marriage broke up, but that was my wish. And it was. And now you're hearing the whole story. I almost got caught in a lie, and I swore off. No more, it's not worth it. I'm gonna be satisfied with what I have. Barbara, what you have is what every woman in the world would love to have. You have a husband that's faithful to you, that brings home his paycheck, and it was a very good paycheck. You have two normal, healthy kids. You have a beautiful home. You have a nice car. What else could you want? He gives you jewelry. He gives you money. What else could you want? So I decided I wasn't going to risk it, and I swore off. And we were in the middle of rehearsals for the show, and it was a very intense time, and everybody got exhausted when they were doing this. And we would usually go to Hot Springs after the show was over for a little R&R and continue meeting people there and doing what we shouldn't. And I didn't go that year because my mother got very ill right the day of dress rehearsal. And she was in the hospital and had a stroke, and it just went on and on. And because of the exhaustion with the show, and then my mother's illness, and trying to run her house and my house and take care of the kids and take care of the husbands and make sure Daddy had something to eat, and then he fell. So he moved in with me, and that's when I learned that he was probably addicted to pills, because he said, just get all those pills on my table in the kitchen and my nightstand and just bring them. So I just shoved them. I was in a hurry. I was always in a hurry. Still am. And sorted them out when we got to the house, and he had three tranquilizers and two sleeping pills. And I said, Daddy, what is all this for? And he proceeded to tell me that he took the one tranquilizer about 10 in the morning, and he took another one, a different one, about 2. And he took another one about 7 that evening, and then I said, and then when do you take the sleeping pills? He says, I take those at night when I can't sleep. And I said, well, how many do you take? And he said, 2. Now, have you ever heard an alcoholic say he ever had more than 2 drinks? How many did you have, honey? 2? You know? So I began to think that maybe there was something wrong with the way he was taking these pills, and called his doctor, and he said, oh, well, he shouldn't. And these were old prescriptions. This was back in the days when they didn't regulate that stuff. He had a friend that was a pharmacist, and he kept saying, George, I'm out of these, and George would give him some more. So he had Equinil, he had Valium, and he had something else, I don't even remember, plus the Secanol and Nembutal. And I called his doctor, and I tattled, is what I did, and I said, he's doing this, and he said, oh, well, let him have one Secanol at night, but take all the rest away from him. Now, we could have killed the man. He's in his 70s. And we're detoxing him without any benefit of medication. And he got a little pissed at me. He told me, he said, I'm 75 years old, and I'll have you know that money will buy you ice water in hell, and you're not going to keep me away from my pills. And as it turned out, I didn't. Mother was gravely ill. She was in the hospital and at home and at hospital and at home. And she, we had sitters with her, and I had to have a housekeeper for Daddy. And one of the housekeepers I found had moved there from Maine, and he had a sister in a small town not far from Fort Smith, and I hired her, and she was a registered nurse, and I found out she was pushing pills to him. I mean, you know, you can only do so much when you're trying to screw around and not be at home and look out after all these things, and you know, you got 9,000 things going, and you're trying to keep them all in the air. You know, you ever heard of a juggler, you know, that's keeping all this? Well, that was me. And then some friends thought that it would be good for me to go to the state golf tournament, because I had never been able to go, and I really needed a break. I really had been just burning it at both ends, and I was really tired. And I wasn't screwing around at this time because I'd almost gotten caught, remember? And I said, okay, I'll go. Well, I went. We played 5 days, and I won my flight. Now, I'm not going to tell you what my flight was, but I want it, and I have this real pretty brass ice bucket, and it's engraved and the whole thing, and I liked it. And my friends that were fooling around too were with me, and The first night we were there, they said, come on, go to the bar with us. Our friends are meeting us, and they brought one for you. I said, not me. I've sworn off. It's not worth it. It's too dangerous, and I'm not going to risk what I've got. And they said, well, one drink won't hurt you. It's the first drink, folks. I know that today. I agreed to go, and I met him. And he was tall, a foot taller than me. His legs are 1 foot taller than mine. Had on cowboy boots. Now, some of you heard me talk about how I like boots. And he had on a big belt buckle and one of them hats. And it just, something clicked. I really don't know what, but something clicked. And all my good intentions just went, and they were gone. And we spent that summer, I spent it on the road between Fort Smith and Little Rock and Russellville and Conway, wherever I could get him to drive halfway to meet me. I wanted him, I chased him, and I caught him. And his name was Mike, and he was everything I'd ever wanted. And he needed me, and he loved me, and he couldn't live without me. No one needs you more than a practicing alcoholic. And I know that today. I didn't know he was an alcoholic. I had a lot of clues. There were things that happened that if I had been sane, if I had been thinking, I would have recognized as a danger signal. But they didn't ring a bell with me. He loved me, and he needed me, and he couldn't live without me. I had spent one afternoon in Russellville, Arkansas, in the Holiday Inn with him. And I had a trip to Las Vegas planned, my husband and I. And I told him that I would be out of town and I wouldn't be able to go to this thing that was going on. And he over and over said, I don't want you to go. I want you with me. I want you all my life. I want us to grow old together. And I want to put our teeth in the same glass. You know, God, it was romantic. And he was tall, and he was handsome, and he wore boots, and he had the buckle, and he had a horse. And he loved me, and he needed me. And I was late getting home, and my husband was always home, because usually I beat him, and he was already home, and he said, where you been? And I said, well, I've been in Russellville. They're filming this movie there with John Wayne. So you know how long ago this has been. And we were watching them, and I had this whole long story. I mean, I don't even know where it came from, but it just popped in my head, and I just blah, 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 poured it out. And he bought it. He's believing me, poor man. And I said, no, wait a minute, stop this craziness. I said, Richard, that's not true. I've been with another man, and I want to leave you, and I want a divorce. Well, he, needless to say, his teeth fell out of his mouth almost. Because of Mother's illness and all the stress I was under, I had been telling him that I really felt like I was kind of at loose ends. And I really thought I needed to talk to a therapist. And I had an appointment with a psychiatrist for like another month from now that I'd waited like 3 months for. And Richard's answer to my announcement was, I think we better call that psychiatrist. Because, of course, anyone that would want to leave him must be crazy. And I was. I didn't know it then, but I was. So, long story short, I ended up in the nut ward of Sparks Hospital in Fort Smith, Arkansas, in the locked ward, and I signed myself in, and then these people started talking to me and wanted to know if I was suicidal and if I was, you know, depressed and if I was, and this psychiatrist came in and he says, all right, tell me what's going on. So I kind of related some of this to him, and he said, okay, we're going to do some blood tests and some medical tests and see. And I said, oh, and by the way, I've been taking diet pills for 2-3 years, And I don't think anybody knows that. And it's true. Now, I never abused them. Never took more than one a day. It's the only time I was ever able to lose weight, as you can tell, was when I was taking diet pills. And he said, oh, well, let's check for chemical imbalances here. So sure enough, I had some bad chemical imbalances. And in 3 days, they let me out because I was going to Las Vegas, of course. I mean, I couldn't miss that. We were going to see Tom Jones and Elvis Presley, and you just don't miss weekends like that. So we did. And we agreed to, this was early September, of course, over Labor Day, and we agreed to go see the psychiatrist and do marriage counseling. And Richard, poor thing, didn't know what hit him. He was just doing his job, being himself, being locked up, not sharing anything, just going to work, coming home, going to work, coming home, playing golf on weekends. We had a deal that he could play golf all weekend if he took me out Friday and Saturday night. That was the way we worked it. And we did. And then pretty soon it was like Sunday night too, and then Thursday night, and maybe one other night during the week. Because what Barbara wanted, Barbara got. Ended up going to marriage counseling for a month. And I had told the doctor about all these other men, but I hadn't told Richard, and he told me that I probably needed to do that. And when I did, of course, that was the end. He cut off the credit cards. He cut off all this other stuff. And I ended up moving into an apartment. And I hurt an awful lot of people. I hurt him, and I hurt my kids. Because, you see, I left them with my husband. It was a good decision, and I know that today, but it was for the wrong reason. I didn't want to take them away from their school and their friends and their house and their father, and I wasn't sure where I was going to end up. I knew I wasn't going to be in Fort Smith, Arkansas. So I used that excuse for not taking them with me. They were 15 and 16 at the time, and they were driving, and they were independent the way I had raised them. And because of that, they never had to live with active alcoholism. So it turned out to be the right decision, but my motives were certainly off. We hurt Mike's wife and his children, and I'm here to tell you that the other woman never gets him. I did. Boy, did I. He lied about me. He lied to me about everything about him except his name and what he did for a living. He lied to me about his age. He lied to me about his children's ages. He lied to me about his parents. I mean, there wasn't anything that was a shred of truth except his name and what he did for a living, and he lost that shortly. We had some good times. We were together for about a year and a half, maybe 2 years, before he stopped drinking. I lived with him before we were married. When my divorce was final, we moved to Pine Bluff, Arkansas, to this little hole-in-the-wall apartment that was all we could afford, because I'd never worked. I mean, I didn't have any money. I had a little alimony coming in. I had a smart attorney. And he left his wife and his children. He told me they were 6 and 8 and they were 3 and 5. You know, and my kids were 15 and 16, and I've got babies coming on weekends, and it's like, God, deliver me. We used to get up on Friday after work and drive, load the horses up, and we'd go miles. We'd go into Mississippi, we'd go into Oklahoma, we'd go into North Louisiana for cuttings. I don't know if you know what a cutting horse is, but they cut cows out of herds and hold them there. Today I still like to see a cutting horse work because it's natural. You don't whip them to do it, and you don't beat them to do it. It's just kind of in them. And we'd go to cuttings. And he'd ride, and I got to hold the horse. Or maybe he'd let me warm it up just at a very slow walk long before he went into the ring. And his trademark, everyone knew that he was drinking. I mean, they all did. Cowboys drink, okay? They do a lot of it. And he always had a great big malt cup full of vodka and 7-Up. And while he was warming the horse up or just getting ready before he went in the ring, he always had this malt cup sitting on his saddle horn. And he's very cool and very swavy and demeanor. And he could ride a horse one-handed and hold that drink, never spill a drop. And when he got ready to go in and perform, compete, he would hand me his drink, and I would hold it like a good little girl until he got through, and then give it back. And I did a lot of drinking, too. My first husband and I drank a lot. We partied a lot. I learned to drink scotch so I wouldn't have hangovers anymore, because I got tired of wasting Sundays, spending them in bed feeling bad. So someone told me if I learned to drink scotch, I wouldn't feel that way, and you know I didn't. And I still drink scotch today. One drink, you know. Things went on. We took geographical cures, like most people involved with alcoholics do. We moved 9 times in the first year and a half we were together, and some of that was before we were married. I still know how to pack, so if anyone needs help, let me know, and I'll give you the benefit of my experience. We ended up moving back to Fort Smith, and we ended up living right down the street from where my parents were living after I had forced Daddy to sell his house because it had a lot of stairs and to move into a flat duplex. It was very nice and very new, but I didn't give him a vote. I just said, sell the house, move, and took care of it. I had a little trouble understanding that I had a problem with control when I got here. And when I thought about that, it made perfect sense. Well, of course I do. He did things with checkbooks that I don't know anyone's ever done. Of course, I'm unique, you see. My first husband was a businessman, and I have trouble adding 2 and 2 and getting 4, so he wouldn't let me bank where he did. I mean, I had to go to a whole separate bank. And Mike wanted me to handle our finances. Excuse me. And what he really didn't want to do was fool with it. And so he pushed it off on me, and I accepted it. And I felt very responsible. But it's real hard balancing a checkbook when, number one, he can't drink and work, and number two, he's lying about what he makes, and number three, he's taking checks out of the back of the book and writing them, and you don't know it until the bank statement comes in, and he's falsifying deposit slips. If he deposited $100, he'd change it to a 7, and I'm calling the bank. Well, you get the picture. You know. There were some times when I understand I was about this far ahead of the sheriff coming after me for hot checks because, of course, they were my checks. He didn't want his name on the account. Why am I not surprised? I remember one time I lived in Pine Bluff, and we lived not far from the hospital, and as it turned out, it was okay because the clues that I had early on that he was an alcoholic were nothing compared to the night that he got mad over something. I don't even remember what. And I was getting dressed to go to Temple to the high holiday services. And something happened, and I was grabbed, and the dress was torn, and I ran, and he was screaming and had me backed in. I'd never faced anything like that. I didn't know what that was. And I ran and locked myself in the bathroom, which was a mistake because I stood too close to the door, and when he kicked it open, it hit me in the head, and I had a gash, and I didn't even feel it. And he said, oh, my God, what have I done? And he took me to the emergency room, and he left the car for me, and he walked home, and I got stitched up, and everything was fine. And he'll never do it again. But it scared me because I'd never seen that kind of anger. I had never lived with violence. I'd hardly had anyone raise their voice to me. And it scared me. And a few months later, we were living in Little Rock, and he had started a new job, and it was a new beginning, and things were going to be better, and it was a geographical cure, and he got mad at something and grabbed me and slung me around, and my head hit the kitchen cabinet, and so I had one going this way. They're both right here. The hair covers them. But he begged me. He said, please don't tell anybody. I might lose my job. And I didn't. But I got in my car. Catch a public service announcement by Al-Anon Family Groups, and you may have seen it. It's the one where it's nighttime and she's looking out the window and the rain's coming down, and the voiceover says, you can see what his drinking is doing to him, but can you see what it's doing to you? I remember it, but it didn't make a great impact, and it didn't send me running to Al-Anon. And a few months later, when we were living in Fort Smith, I remembered a couple that my first husband and I had known that partied with us, but when they partied, they got so drunk and so obnoxious that we just kind of quit inviting them. And I had heard later that they had sobered up in AA. Now, I had no idea what AA was. I didn't have any idea. But I called Brooksine and I asked her if they would come talk to him. And she agreed, and they did. And they were low-bottom alcoholics, so their stories were really bad. They're both alcoholics. And she's got scars on her face where he beat her up, and he tells of the time that he tried to commit suicide by wrapping a 155-pound block of ice tied to his waist and jumping off into a lake. Now, alcoholic thinking is he forgot that ice floats. He was an insurance man, and he knew it was a surefire way to do it, and his family would get the insurance. Brad has always been involved with little theater, and he's very dramatic, and I went to school with both these people. And I know them quite well. They came and talked to us, and she took me to my first Al-Anon meeting on July 22nd, 1976. I don't know if she's ever been before that, and I don't know if she's been since, but she took me to my first Al-Anon meeting, and I'll always be grateful to her. I talked to her last weekend, and it was good to talk to her. I don't remember a lot past that time. I started going to meetings, and I'd go out for coffee with him, and I'd call him and say, you want to join us? And, of course, nothing more than a practicing alcoholic wants to do is go to Denny's and have coffee with recovering AAs and Al-Anons. So he said no. And I wanted him to get sober so much because I knew that would take care of all our problems if he would only quit drinking. He did eventually quit drinking, and 6 weeks later, we moved to Baton Rouge. We didn't know anybody here. His brother lived in Prairieville, and we knew him, and he got a job here. That's the only reason we moved here, was because he couldn't get a job in Fort Smith. And I really wasn't too keen on staying there because, you see, I really wasn't too happy by then to admit that maybe I'd made my first mistake. I had married this alcoholic, and now people were going to know, so it was best if I get out of town. And we moved to Baton Rouge, and he got a job. And the one thing we did right was that we jumped into both programs. He was 6 weeks sober, and we were scared. And there's two or three people here that I met early on when I first came here. And it's so good to see them. Because, see, I feel like a fraud up here. I'm not a long-timer. You know, Daisy and Nancy and Eric, Aaron and Leatrice, I mean, God, that's great. They were here when I got here. And unfortunately, I go to a lot of meetings today that nobody was there when I came in. I heard a lot of things in my first meeting that made me keep coming back, and most of you have heard me say them, so I'm not going to repeat them, but I did keep coming back. I felt better for having been there. It gave me an hour and a half of peace, without fear, without worry, without dread. I kept hearing that, you know, you have to give it back to keep it. I kept hearing that you have to work the steps. Well, those steps didn't really apply to me, you understand. If he would do this, this, and this, then he'd be okay. But I didn't need that because there really wasn't anything wrong with me. I'd made this one little tiny mistake, but I'd be okay as soon as he stopped drinking. I got hold of someone that, thank God, got hold of me and told me, no, they're for you too. I shared not long ago at a meeting that in the back of my One Day at a Time book that cost $4 when I bought it, and there were 10,000 groups in the United States, around the world at that time, and I had to save 4 weeks to get it because we didn't have any money. And I saved $1 a week for 4 weeks to buy my ODAT. And I still have that same ODAT. And in the back of the book where the steps are listed, and it says in step 2, restore me to sanity, I couldn't buy that because I wasn't crazy. Now, I'd been in the nut ward, but I wasn't crazy. You know, I had chased this alcoholic, but I wasn't crazy. I've scratched out sanity, and I've written wholeness up there. So there wasn't anything wrong with me. Thank God I got hold of some healthy people that helped me a lot. And one of the things I kept hearing was service work. Our triangle has three sides, and if you're doing recovery through the steps and unity through the traditions, but you're not doing the concepts through service, you're cheating yourself. And God knows I've always been greedy, so I wanted it all. And I started dipping my toe into service work. I would chair a meeting, or I would set up chairs, or I would fix a coffee or clean up afterward. And then I learned that you could get a trip out of town without him, and someone would pay for it. So I became a GR, and I never did have the courage to ask to go because, see, I was still asking for permission to do things in my life from him, whoever the him of the moment seems to be. But I did go the last assembly of that term, and just things worked out. And it was an election assembly, and now I hadn't been a very good GR because I didn't know what it was and what they did. And I was elected DR for my district when there were two districts in Baton Rouge. And I thought, well, okay, I guess there's a book I can read. And there was. And I went not long, some of you heard me last year introducing Arbutus, say that's where I met her, was at a convention, and I was sharing with her that I was a new DR, and she started asking me all these knowledgeable questions, and I didn't know what she was talking about, and she said, honey, you're dangerous. She said, you need to get your manuals and read them. Because I really hadn't, and it really is in there. I got a large spurt of growth from doing service work. Now, I'd been doing all the right things. I've been going to meetings. I had sponsor. I used the telephone. I used prayer and meditation. I read my books. I did everything. When I got here, someone said at a meeting they were so glad they married an alcoholic, and I said, you dumb bitch, to myself. How can you be grateful you married an alcoholic? I also heard a little prayer that goes something like, God, thank you for all you've given me. Thank you for all you have taken from me. And thank you for all you have left me. Well, he had given me a drunk husband. He had taken from me security and respect and dignity and courage. And he had left me with just the dregs, bitterness and unhappiness and fear. I didn't like some of the things I first heard in Al-Anon, because they kept trying to tell me there was something wrong with me. And by golly, it wasn't me. It was him. Now, he quit drinking, but things didn't get a whole lot better. He was not a happy, sober, recovering alcoholic. He just quit drinking. I walked on eggshells for 3 years, waiting on him to get happy. And my sponsor, I would go to her and I'd say, he's doing yanny, yanny, yanny. She said, well, it's only the first year. And it's real hard on him the first year. And, you know, it takes some a little longer than others. And just give him a little more time. So I decided, well, okay, I can do that. And I went to her the second year, and I said, same song, second verse. And she said, well, you know, it takes some of them a little longer to get a handle on it. Give him a little more time. So I said, okay, I guess I can do that. So I went to her the third year, and I said, that's enough of this stuff. You know, that's all. And about that time, they had the 1980 International Convention in New Orleans, and we were able to go down for like a day. We didn't get to go for the whole thing. And I saw recovering alcoholics that were happy. And I was amazed. I didn't know there were that sort of thing. You know, I'd seen a lot of them in meetings, and they appeared to be happy, but these were people from everywhere else. You know, they weren't in my town. They couldn't possibly know what I'd gone through. So I decided that I was going to start working the program for me. I was going to do some of the things that I'd been hearing in meetings, and I did. I started detaching, and I started seriously listening to what I had heard and trying to put them in practice. One of the things that amazed me was when I tried to turn it over. And we got a house that was a gift. God gave us this gift and allowed us to buy a house when we had no credit, no money, you know. And we had this house, and it had beautiful live oak trees, and I loved the trees, and I still like the house. And it was my job to rake the leaves, and it was his job to take the bags to the street. And some of you have heard this, so bear with me. And I have a kind of a little thing that if you tell it over three times, you're nagging. So I told him when I got through, I said, the leaves are ready to be taken to the street. And he said, oh, okay. And he's watching football or something. And I didn't think anything about it. And then later that evening, I looked out to take, and they weren't on the street. And they were still in the backyard. And I said, the leaves need to be taken to the street. People will pick them up and use them for mulch if you'll get them out there. Yeah, okay. So I said, all right. And the next morning when I got up, the damn leaves and the bags were still in the backyard. And I thought, they say that if you turn it over to God and let him take care of the outcome, that things will be okay. I think I'm going to try that. So I started getting ready for work, and I said, God, I'm going to let you worry about those bags of leaves. And I got ready for work, and I looked out the window, and the bags were gone. I don't know how they got there. I never heard him leave the house. I never heard him in the backyard, but they were gone, and they were on the street. So I got a little more comfortable with let go and let God turn it over. And things went along, and I was working in service work on the state level and the local level, and I had to look at my motives, because when I had been Mrs. Richard Yaffe in Fort Smith, Arkansas, and chairing this committee and in charge of that thing and this event, I liked it because it made me feel okay with the other people that I thought were so far superior to me. And since I didn't have any money now, and I certainly had no standing now, and didn't know all these people now, I was really feeling inferior. And I had to look at why I wanted to do it. Was it for recognition, or was it for people to like me, or was it because I felt obligated to give something back to Al-Anon? And I really think that's what it was. I really feel obligated that to share some of what I've been given and give it back. And I did that, and Tanya told you what I've done, and I've done it, and you know. And I never knew how to do any of those things. No one ever asked me when they asked me to be DR, do you know how? No one ever asked me if I knew how to be a chairman of the AIS office. No one ever asked me if I knew how to be a PI coordinator or an Alateen sponsor or chairman of the assembly or World Service delegate. All they wanted to know was if I was willing, and I have been. And it's made all the difference in the world in my program and in my life. I told you that I really didn't, I did mind the drinking, but what really bothered me was the lying. he couldn't tell the truth. When it was easier to tell the truth, he would tell a lie. So then he had to take care of it with another one and then another one. Is it hot in here?
Yes.
Could we have some air? And in August one year, I caught him in a lie. Now, to my knowledge, he had stopped lying when he stopped drinking. He didn't get happy, but he quit lying, and it was great, and it was okay. And I could almost learn to trust him again. Never did learn to trust him with a checkbook. Was just about getting there. Just about getting there, and we split up. Caught him in a lie, a little one. Didn't matter that much, but it kind of sent up this flag. And later on, it was a bigger one and a bigger one and a bigger one. And in January, we separated. Now, we had been married almost 10 years. I had been in this program 10 years. Thank you, God. And I knew that something wasn't right, but I choose not to live with a liar. I may one day live with a practicing alcoholic again. I don't think so, but I might. But I will never live with a liar again that I know of. So we split up, and we were working on it. And we went to a counselor, and he saw us singly, and he saw us together. And what I was doing was for him to come to his senses so that we could be happy. Well, I was still where I was 10 years ago when I came in this program. And I did a lot of things during that separation. I had a lot of things happen to me. My father died, whom I had worshipped, been daddy's little girl. Because Mike came to his funeral, and I didn't know daddy hated Mike as much as he did, but unfortunately when things really got bad, he was the only one I had to talk to, so he knew most of the gory details, and he hated him. And when Mike showed up at his funeral, the kids got furious because daddy had talked to them about how they hated him, and they didn't think he should be there, and I didn't know this, and I didn't know he was coming, but he was there to support me. So the kids decided that I really wasn't a very good mother, that I was sadly lacking, and they just really didn't want anything to do with me. I had moved out of this house that was a gift, and I had moved out gladly. My marriage ultimately ended. We were separated a year and a half before we divorced, but the last straw was the dog died. Now, I had handled all these things and coped with them, and then my dog died. Thor had been part of my first divorce settlement, and he was part of my second divorce settlement, and boxers usually don't live that long, so I was really given a gift that he was there for me through that year of separation. But that was the straw that broke the camel's back for me. I had coped beautifully, thank you. I was working the Al-Anon program, thank you, but I was falling apart inside. I've learned since I left Richard, I can buy cars all by myself. I can buy a house. I know how to shop for insurance. I know how to, I've learned to grow up. I have grown up. The woman that moved to Baton Rouge was almost still a spoiled little brat that still wanted everything done for her. Now, there are days today when I wouldn't mind that much at all, but most of the time I'm fully capable of doing things for myself. First time it really struck me that I really need a man around was when it froze that Christmas 3 or 4 years ago and my pipes froze and I didn't have any firewood and I had the flu. And it was just too much. You know, I just needed someone to handle that for me. When I first got here, there was so much that I really couldn't handle the Serenity Prayer. It was just too intellectual for me because I didn't know what I could change and what I couldn't change, and I certainly didn't feel like I had any wisdom because nothing was working out the way I thought it ought to. And I latched on to a little prayer that goes, Lord, help me to remember that nothing's going to happen to me today that you and I can't handle together. It put today in perspective for me. And that helped a lot. And I have it on my desk at work, and I have it in my kitchen, and I have it in my bathroom. And I mean, I use that still today. And there have been a lot of days that I have looked up and said, it's too damn much. But I've survived. I'm here, and I've survived all those things. Today, I have friends. When I bought my house, I let it be known at my home group that I was going to be moving and I could use any help that anyone wanted to give me. Well, I don't even remember, but there were like 25 people that showed up and like two or three vans and a couple of pickups and cars and station wagons, and everybody moved me in one day. And they were all Al-Anon friends. There were no paid movers. There was nobody's brother-in-law, sister-in-law's dad with a moving service. These were friends of mine. We divorced in August, and I bought my house and moved in the following August, a year afterward. When I think of him, I'm not going to get ahead of myself. I got my little notes here, folks, on butterfly paper. When I was given the honor of being elected World Service Delegate for the state of Louisiana, I thought, oh, that's such a big responsibility, and it's so hard work, and it's, I don't know how to do this. But you see, all they asked was if I was willing. And I was, and one of the benefits that I got from that was the fact that the conference isn't held in New York City anymore. They moved years ago, and they have it usually in Connecticut or in the surrounding areas up there somewhere. And the years that I went, it was in Stamford, Connecticut, and my daughter lived in Fairfax, Connecticut, which is like 30 miles away. And my daughter and I had started mending fences, and I spent the weekends with her for conference, and we started healing our relationship. That was one of the benefits of being delegate. One of the other benefits of being delegate was being part of the conference that told them to move out of New York City because it was too expensive. And I'm gratified to see that other people felt that was smart too, because they'll be moving next year to Norfolk, Connecticut. After the divorce, I didn't hate Mike. Now, I played a lot of games during the period of the divorce and the separation, especially after I found out he was going to get married again. And we weren't divorced yet, and he hadn't been served with papers yet. And he was planning to divorce the day after, to be married the day after we divorced. And I said, that's your ass. I work for attorneys, and I can figure out how to do this. And I delayed his wedding a few times by not getting my divorce. And every time I do that, you know, his attorney would get this notice that we've requested a continuance, because that's what it's called in legal talk. He'd call me up, and he'd call me every name in the book, screaming and yelling over the phone, and then I would get the privilege of hanging up on him. Now, I didn't play games, you understand. This was serious. But anyway, after we divorced, and he did get married the next day, and I threw a big party that night for a lot of my friends, and someone walked in and said, are you giving him a wedding reception? And I said, no, this is my reception. Anyway, my good friends were there, some AAs and some Al-Anons, and we had a good time. And my life has moved on. We've been divorced 9 years, I think. It's really not important now. You know, you get to a point where you forget. A couple of years ago, I got lonely, and I get lonely. This is not the ending I wrote, okay? At my age and my stage in life, I should be sitting back eating bonbons and my grandchildren crawling on my knee. Well, I don't have any grandchildren except by marriage. I have granddogs. It's not the ending I wrote, okay? A couple of years ago, 3 years ago, I got lonely, and I started talking to God about it, and I said, if you think I'm ready, I'm lonely, and I think I'd like a companion. I'd like someone that, you know, would like to go places with me and will sit and watch TV with me at night and be good to me and cuddle up in bed with me at night. And I did that for about 6 months. And one day some friends knocked on my front door and they said, I think we have a surprise for you. And in runs this full-grown boxer dog, a lot like the one I lost. He's male. He likes to go places with me. He loves to cuddle in the bed. And we watch TV together. My God has a sense of humor. I forgot to say 6'4" and two-legged and human. So I have this dog. And Baron is wonderful. You know, he's just... But he's not human. One of the things a past delegate gets to do, I'm trying to watch the time. How is it? When did I start? Oh, dear. Okay, well, this is short. Okay, I'm winding up, y'all, if you can hang on. One of the things a past delegate gets to do is go to the regional delegates seminar, regional delegates get together meeting, which keeps the current delegate aware of what's going on in, at the conference, what to be prepared for, and lets the past delegates know also what's been on going on since they were there. And it was held in Little Rock this year and in early March. And I've been to Little Rock a lot of times since the divorce, and he lives there, okay? He lives there. And I've never felt threatened, and I've never felt worried about going there, that I just knew I wouldn't run into him. Well, guess what? I did. He was in the skit that the host committee entertains after the dinner Saturday night, and he walked out on the stage, and I didn't recognize him until he opened his mouth because he's gone totally gray, and he's losing his hair. And his line was, part of his line was, God, if you just help me with this, I'll never say anything bad to another Al-Anon again. Isn't that great? I love it. He saw me in the audience and he lost his line. I got shook, okay? I was some shocked. I had to leave the meeting after the entertainment was over, and I was sitting out in the lobby and I was talking to my higher power, and I said, what in the hell do you want me to learn from this? Because see, my higher power and I talk like that. I said, you know, this is my place. He doesn't have any business here. This is Al-Anon. He's an AA. You know, what is... And I felt better. I had someone came out that needed help, and God knows I like to help people. And, you know, I felt better, and I had a nightmare that night, and I know why, you know. And the next morning, I'm in the business meeting, ready to go up and do my thing, and I feel this on my shoulder, and I turn, and he's kneeling at my feet, as well he should be. And the shock that I felt the night before was totally gone. And I said, well, hi, Mike, how are you doing? And he said, can you visit a minute? And I said, yeah, let's go outside. And long story short, we visited for a couple of hours. And you know how when you first get in the program and you hear about the ninth step, made direct amends? I never got mine. You know, you wait on them. You think you're due them? They owe them to you? After all, you're the long-suffering little spouse. And we were talking, and it dawned on me he was making amends to me. I have never had a prayer answered so quickly. Because Saturday night, what am I supposed to get from this? And Sunday morning, I'm getting amends that I thought I should have gotten 18 years ago. You know, and I'm getting them now. And it's different today because I don't have to think of him. Now, I hadn't been dwelling on resentment, okay? But when I thought of him, I didn't think of him fondly, shall we say. He's the person that I've had to pray for. You know, like they say, if you got a problem with someone, you better pray for them. And I didn't want to. And my prayer was, God, you know I don't want them to be happy.
but you give them whatever you think they need. And it took me longer than 2 weeks. My sponsor said do it for 2 weeks. I lost count at about 3 or 4 months, but you know, eventually it did go away. I don't have to think of him with anything but compassion and care today. The man I divorced is not the man I saw in Little Rock a few weeks ago. He has apparently now found recovery. He is a recovering alcoholic. Of course, the fact that he's working with Joe McHugh of the Big Book Study probably doesn't hurt anything, but it's good to see, and I'm very glad. I wouldn't want anyone to be as miserable as he was. And I'd just like to close by saying the little prayer. God, thank you for what you have given me. You have given me friends without measure. Thank you for what you have taken from me. You have taken greed and pride and arrogance for the most part. And God, thank you for what you have left me. And you have left me with a real sense of who I am and what I'm for. And I'm okay. I'm number one, and I'm worth it. And I appreciate that, and I'm very grateful. Thank you very much.